think we have a quorum. It's time to start the podcast. This is Hope This Helps, a podcast that only requires a quorum of two.
A quorum of two?
A quorum of two. And of those two, my name is Steve.
And I'm Tiffany.
And that's all we need. So here's what we hope helps you this time.
Wait, what are we? Are we helping people with things?
We're going to be helping people with things.
We got tons of things to help people about.
Yeah, get ready to be helped because we're ready to help you and we help this hopes you.
We help this hopes you?
We help this hopes.
We help this hopes. I'm a natural at messing up words. It's all good.
Sometimes I like intentionally messing up words. It just sounds unintentionally funny to me.
No, I know. That's why I think like help this hopes just sounds funny. It's been that kind of evening / day.
Been that kind of week.
Yeah.
You know, it's been that kind of week for Microsoft too. It's Microsoft Ignite week.
Yeah. I guess like I forgot it was until you told me today.
I actually didn't know until I think I got the reminder email yesterday laying out some kind of security focus schedule for me because apparently I put down security as my topic focus for Ignite.
It just knew.
It just knew. And then it happened. But unfortunately, you know, since it's digital, I had meetings. Wasn't really able to kind of watch a whole lot of anything, except for occasionally just tuning into the live stream thus far. And I don't know, so far I haven't gotten really much of anything out of the whole experience. It's been a lot of generic buzzwords and advertisements and, you know, see also the last two digital Ignites that we experienced and the same kind of complaints there. Granted, it's only day one, but hope it gets better.
So essentially, it's just like a regular everyday meeting with leadership teams.
Basically.
I feel like I need a ba-dum-tch. There were some things that came out of it. I had a quick glance after you informed me that it was Ignite Day / week. And there's some cool things that are that were announced. But however, when I look at the documentation, a lot of the things look like their documentation was updated like 7 days ago. So I just feel like they were announced, but like everyone else already, I feel like I was just late to the party.
Same. For a lot of the Ignite announcements, there's so many events that I might be better off just looking and skimming through tech news articles like a day or a few hours later to even figure out what was even announced. Because a lot of the time, even if I am paying attention, I'll still miss stuff, like genuinely.
That's what I did. I just started Googling for stuff that I was interested in because any of the sessions that I wanted to go to, they were either booked and then it was just like kind of the leftover ones were just not interesting at all. Just things I don't care about.
Right. Yeah, that's a weird place
not
to be.
Not trying to be a jerk, but like I want to see more of like the technical deep dives, and those either had limited capacities or just were closed. And I get I was late to the party, but I just wasn't excited or thrilled.
What day is today? Today is Tuesday. At the time of this recording, it has only been the first day of Ignite, and we've only had a few keynotes, so hopefully we'll get better as the week progresses, and maybe something truly incredible will be announced at the end of the week, and we won't just be hearing things about, you know, the upteenth time that we get a speech about the cloud and security and just how dang scalable it is and innovative it is and how it makes you do more and empowers you.
Yes to all those things. I think what is becoming problematic is just the scale of all of these products and how they all integrate into everything. It's almost impossible to keep up.
Microsoft could also kind of help by not renaming these products every so often as well. Like, do you know what Defender is now? Because Microsoft seems to want to call it something different. And, oh man, it's, you know, just keep it one name. That's all I ask.
Yeah, no, I agree. We got to stop changing names. Something that is exciting that they did announce, at least for like the DevOps side of the world, was a preview of the fully managed serverless container service for microservices. So it scales based on internet traffic. From what I understand and what I was reading, is there was already a similar product in AWS.
Is this, so this Kubernetes is kind of, by any chance?
No, it's not Kubernetes. It's supposed to be like, from what I was reading, it's a Kubernetes Lite. It's supposed to be much easier to manage than Kubernetes. while Kubernetes is getting more support for various things, like there's a solution that's been announced for Oracle WebLogic Server and then also the IBM WebSphere. So there are cool things that have been added to both that really enhance the products. But again, it lets you also scale out your Kubernetes environment, but also simplifies containers. So it lets you build your containers on your desktop, and then you can more easily move them into Azure now because they'll have a place to live.
Nice. So it will allow for some multi-cloud capabilities.
Exactly. And allowing you to then use the Azure Arc to really use the capabilities of the S3 buckets that AWS has.
So multi-cloud, it reminds me of when anytime they say multi-cloud, A, take a drink, and B, we'll link it in the show notes. There is a scene from a Futurama episode where it's multi-ball. Whenever you see multi-cloud, you just think of when you get three balls locked, you get the multi-ball. And you get points bonus for using multiple clouds and combining them. And you keep using them until you start losing them because you can't juggle them all at once. Multi-ball.
It's so funny that everything is moving to this open source or this multi-cloud or that hybrid multi-ball. Is even coming back. Multi-ball. Because back when I worked at the Apple store in circa 2009, they did this whole training on like the ecosystem. And like stay with an Apple and keep Apple. And now it's just like, no, mix and match everything. And Microsoft tried to do that too with Azure and their whole Microsoft environment. Now you're seeing, no, you can be friends with AWS. And AWS is like, no, I don't want to be friends with them.
Microsoft announces all these products to integrate with their clouds. And I'm like, did the other clouds have any say in this? Do they want Microsoft to do this?
Do they want to be friends with you? Like, do they want to hold hands?
There was some announcement. They were like, oh, yeah, we'll make this thing in AWS better. And I'm like, is that a slight towards AWS or something? Is that Microsoft saying we can move in and just fix their house when it's not even their house?
Yeah, it's not. This isn't even your house.
Yeah, I didn't ask you to repaint the walls and move the furniture. This is Commander Bezos land. This isn't Satya's.
Yeah, Commander Bezos. Well, from what I understand is that AWS has the simple storage service, the S3 bucket, and there's still only some providers or like platforms and services that only use the S3 bucket. So then you're kind of like married to AWS, or you have to like get AWS an AWS account. So I think that's really where like Azure Arc comes into play, and having the multi-cloud and being able to use containerized, because then you can one have a true high availability, full scaled solution.
Azure Arc, do.
That's going to get stuck in everyone's head.
I hope it does, because it's been stuck in my head, and now y'all can suffer along with me.
Azure Arc, do-do-do-do-do.
You're welcome for
that. That's a good one.
You're welcome, Internet.
Thank you. It's going to be stuck in my head for life. I don't know.
I think that was stuck in my head since they announced Azure Arc at Ignite 2019. The first thing in my head was just the Baby Shark song with Azure Arc.
Azure Arc, do-do-do-do-do. Azure Arc, do-do-do. Thanks, Steve.
I'm going to make a graphic of that in some way.
Can you please?
I'm going to draw that. That's going to be like the new Help This Hopes. Help This.
Yes.
The new Hope This Helps logo in the near future.
But with the shark, I have an image in my head too. So after this, I might actually go draw something up to the Azure shark.
We needed a logo, and I think now we just thought of one. Yes.
I'm just picturing like a shark, like a baby shark wearing like a floaty. I don't know why a floaty, but don't judge me.
Okay.
Don't do it. But instead of like Docker, it'll be the Azure shark.
Yeah, because the Docker is like a whale, so it's like its cousin.
It's a whale. Yeah. I thought it was a submarine for a long time, and then I realized that it was
You kind of have to look up close before you realize, oh yeah, it's not a submarine or any kind of vehicle. It's actually a whale. A Docker, you might say.
A Docker. Wow. This just got weird.
So what are they calling this Microsoft Ignite? Because it's technically the second one in 2021. So is it technically 21H2 Microsoft Ignite? Do they need to start labeling
like
them
that.
Like they label Windows 10 and Windows 11, I guess?
Yeah, so this is H2?
Yeah, this would be H2 because it was the second Ignite, because we had one in the very beginning of the year. It was the Microsoft Ignite 2020 Part 2, I guess. held in 2021.
I see where you're going with this. I think so.
But the point of that was they wanted to make it so you could, you know, have more options and more sessions to join. And they just had so many events. And to follow up with that, there was, I think, Mary Jo Foley during one of the live events today. I heard this live. I don't know if it's written down anywhere, but, and I quote, "It's like a Big Mac. Have it your way." And I was like, wait a minute. The Big Mac is McDonald's and have it your way is Burger King.
That's brilliant that they mixed both.
Is that an odd metaphor for multi-cloud where I can just bring a Big Mac into a Burger King? I think we're onto something here.
I think so. So does that mean you can put the Mac sauce on your Burger King burger?
You can bring the Szechuan sauce into the opposite establishment and then you realize you're actually at a Wendy's.
Right. Where they don't have frozen patties. So is that like the Google Cloud or the Alibaba Cloud?
Or the Western Digital Cloud that they're shutting down on older devices.
Actually, funny story that you say that because that actually does meet the Wendy's situation. So when I was in high school, I had a job at Wendy's. It was like my second week into Wendy's. And all of a sudden we stopped getting paychecks. And turns out that the guy who owned the franchise of the particular Wendy's that I worked at, and there was like three other locations, took the money and ran. So we didn't, like, we had to work for like 4 or 5 weeks before anyone realized that this guy just like took off with the money.
That's
so
not great.
That's actually pretty appropriate when you think about it.
So we ran off to another cloud.
Yeah. So we went to go cash our checks at the bank, and like for a couple weeks they were like, yeah, nope, good. They would cash the checks. And then by the third week, they started denying cashing the checks and we couldn't figure out why. Well, we found out why.
Oh.
So that's the cloud for you.
Yes, it is.
Wendy's. So yeah, so they shut down the Wendy's and it was such a strange situation. That was my little aside for tonight. My weird story about that time I worked at Wendy's for like 2 weeks. It was more than 2 weeks because...
It's okay. It was my fault. I derailed the whole conversation to begin
with.
No,
but it weirdly was an okay story.
Yeah, it was. I appreciate that you told the story.
Yeah. No, here we go. Moving on. We don't need to hear about my work life stories and the weird jobs that I had. It's okay.
It's all good. Mine either. Mine are so equally odd.
What else at Ignite? Oh, so another song this evening. I saw someone tweet about this, or they tweeted this phrase, "Loop, there it is." When I saw that, I actually started singing it without even seeing this tweet. So I thought that was really appropriate and perfect in all of the ways.
So loop, I know you explained this to me before, but so it's meant to be a notes application, but it's not Microsoft OneNote. It's not Whiteboard, but it's not supposed to be a replacement for them. Yet it is, but isn't. So what's the story with the loop here?
For the brief few minutes that I saw it and looked into it, it's a collaboration app that allows real time collaboration. I feel like I just use that word a lot.
I was gonna say that was just buzzwords.
Yeah.
So if I think a note-taking application that allows for collaboration, you know what I think? We have one. It's called OneNote. It's a mature product that's existed for about 20 years. And it's like, why did we need to make another one?
Honestly, we didn't. It's not OneNote. It's more of a modern whiteboard version. And I'm going to tell another work story. I'm not going to. I just thought it was perfect.
Yes. I was going to be like, do go on.
So,
but whiteboard. So we have whiteboard.
There
though.
Are
it's called whiteboard.
Several of these apps. Well, okay. Let's be real. Whiteboard sucks.
Yeah,
It's okay. If you like just drawing
without much else, I guess whiteboard's for you. Yeah. No, right. I totally understand. It's kind of a lackluster application that you could do better with other things.
But there are other apps that exist that have caught on, like Notion, Mural. There's other ones out there that really bring whiteboarding to the next level. They are interactive. They have great menu bars. They allow you to like jump through content and just have like these workspaces that are easy to navigate through. Whereas Whiteboard is just this giant board, and it is getting better. But, you know, just having a meeting of 40 people or so, it really bogged it down. Whereas a Mural or a Notion, they hold this content. I think one of the coolest things that I've seen with Mural, for example, is the ability to have like a table of contents. So you know how Whiteboard, you have this just massive space and people are like putting stuff everywhere and you can't find anything. One thing that's cool about Mural is that you have a table of contents and you can actually navigate to that space. So similar to OneNote and Whiteboard. So it's kind of the combination of both of them. But OneNote is great for collaborating like in our own time. Like if, you know, a good use case for a Mural, a Notion, or even Loop is, you know, you have a big meeting and you ask everyone a question of like, how can we improve what shark costume you're going to wear? And everyone kind of can just put up their stickies and in real time. So it allows you to have those conversations and those real time note taking or brainstorming sessions that you could have in an office around a whiteboard without it, but in a hybrid or in a fully remote world. And it kind of removes like that slowness and it keeps people engaged.
That's fair. So it has a purpose. It's like it seems like it's a combination of a couple of other third party products I can probably think of off the top of my head, like probably like RoadMonk, or like you said, I think it was Notion. And of course, internally, Microsoft's Whiteboard. Personally, I think we're just getting dangerously close to Google levels of like how many redundant applications can we have that all integrate into Teams? Because Whiteboard already does integrate into Teams. So now we're going to have Loop right alongside it. Like, can you import your whiteboards into Loop? I'd really hope you could.
I hope so. It doesn't look like it's really coming till 2022. So when I have more than 20 minutes to look into it, I hope that I can learn more about it and see more things, because it is an app that does interest me, because I'm very visual. I need pictures. I need all the things to stay engaged, or else you've lost me. Whereas Teams is overwhelming. And that's one of the, in an agile environment where things are moving very quickly, one of the biggest complaints I've gotten about Teams is that it's isolating, that it's hard for Teams to work inter-team. When you're in an agile environment, you need to be able to hop from team to team to team. And a lot of places just haven't adopted like a full, like what Microsoft was trying to do a couple years ago, of adopted that full on like that full governance of letting users kind of like govern themselves. So we've created these team environments that are like so isolated. And I think Loop is really kind of that intersection that lets teams collaborate cross-functionally.
At the same time though, it does just integrate into Teams as well. So it's sort of like also a bolt-on situation to something that already has problems in itself. So,
but I think that's where like you have to start thinking, I think it kind of forces you to change your governance model when you're bolting it onto Teams.
Right. I know one problem, I kind of experienced the opposite problem with Teams, where like I look at my Teams sidebar, I could be a member of like 50 different teams. And maybe of those 50, like 5 of them are actually active. And that can also
be. So that's part of the problem too, is that, well, that's where it becomes isolating, is that a lot of the teams don't get used. It's intimidating for people who are nervous about like jumping into these conversations. So I'm hoping with time, a better model comes forth, because I haven't like come up with a solution yet. I was really hopeful with shared channels that would help solve some of that. But one, I checked the roadmap today and shared channels is no longer on the roadmap. However, so it's always been under the Teams Connect. Back at the first Ignite this year, they announced Microsoft Teams Connect. It was going to allow you to allow your guests and your internal users. So it was going to allow you to add users to just specific channels. Mind blown. That's perfect. Brilliant.
Yeah. Sounds like a cool feature.
That was supposed to come out in November 2021. So I looked at this last week. It is updated today to preview March 2022.
Oops.
And it doesn't say anything about So it just says shared channels enable people from different orgs to work together as one team in a shared space. But I just want someone from a different team. I don't need them to see the whole team.
Yeah, you only want them to be like in one chat channel. They don't want them to see everything chat channel. Else. There could be confidential information in there and all that. But at the same time, you don't want the only singular junction in teams to be, you know, this one huge or 500-person sized team that's just kind of the junk drawer of Teams chats, you know?
Right, because you don't know where to put all these people. Someone brought to my attention that one of the departments had come up with the solution and they were like so proud of themselves. They were like, they have just all private channels. And I'm just like, no, no, you don't understand.
Yeah,
private channels are the worst for a lot of reasons. And several people were just like, why? And I'm just like, for a lot of reasons, for permissioning on SharePoint, for like when you get rid of them. So you're going to create this team and now you have to add people. Only the owner who created it can now add people. And it's just like, that's a nightmare.
Yeah.
So we're not going to do that for every team. No way. No, I'm not letting that happen.
No. So with Loop, is it married to Teams? Is it stuck? Is it only as good as Teams' governance and, you know, sharing or not share or not share ability that it currently boasts?
So I don't think it's married to Teams.
Is it a service or an application? I guess that's probably...
It's an application.
Oh, okay.
So it can be added to Teams, but it's not married to it.
Okay, so maybe it's like OneNote where you can use it standalone, but you can also integrate it. I guess that might have been better gathered thoughts that I had on it.
Right. So it looks like there will be components that will be arriving in Teams, Outlook, OneNote. So I think it's going to really, I think one of my biggest problems right now, at least for Mac users. So for Windows users, the environment is pretty streamlined. But for Mac users, there's a huge gap.
Yeah.
So if I want to create a to-do item and I can't also import that in OneNote. As a Windows user, I can. I can have that full, like, full cycle ecosystem as if we go back to it. I can't do that on a Mac as easily. And maybe that's what Loop will kind of resolve, is some of those like Windows specific things that work on Windows or just because they've been baked in there for so long.
Yeah. And I think I can understand that. So yeah, OneNote is kind of a great example. Like, it is a masterfully crafted application on Windows, mm-hmm. OneNote 2016 specifically. It's fully featured. It integrates very deeply into like Windows COM objects. It can loop into Outlook. It can do Excel. It has all these features. But the problem is we live in a cross-platform world now where people like yourself, you have a Mac. And while, yes, OneNote does exist on the Mac, it is maybe like 60, 70% of the way compatible with the Windows version, but there's some features, some of those very deeply rooted into Windows features that will just likely never make it into the Mac version. And it's, you know, it's no fault of anybody's. It's just the application is just very old, very mature, does great for what it does on Windows, but on the Mac, it will never get to that point. So maybe that justifies the existence of Loop, because that was born cross-platform from the beginning. And maybe as a result, some of the missing features from OneNote that never made it to the Mac can sort of be reborn in Loop as these new things you can now do, right?
Exactly. Right. So about a month ago, I had done a workshop on OneNote. And one of the biggest things that the users came back to me with was like, hey, this still doesn't resolve the fact that like I have a to-do list here in my OneNote. I like OneNote because I can also put the notes that I have right here. But now how do I get it back in my Outlook? And someone else had the solution of like, oh, just use the to-do app. But then it goes, how do I get those back into OneNote? And I kind of understand wanting that whole like full circle environment because, yeah, I want to see the notes. That's kind of like what we do in the OneNote. We use the notes as a checklist, but we also have our notes that you can't just put in the to-do app. That's a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Like, I think I was trying to demonstrate to someone the other day, there's a feature in Outlook that I really love where you can take a meeting and you open it in Outlook, particularly on the Windows side, and there is a OneNote button inside the ribbon and you can create a OneNote page for this meeting exactly, and it will bring in all the details, the date, the time, the title. It'll even include the list of people that are supposed to be in the meeting, and you can check off who was there and who wasn't. And it's great, but the problem is you have to initiate that from Outlook on the desktop on a Windows machine. And while it is accurate, you can bring this over to the Mac. You have to originate it in Windows and then let it sync to your OneNote notebook, and then it will show up on the Mac side as the generated text. I don't know if you can do that natively on the Mac, though. So it's like you got to do all these workarounds. It's almost like you have to have a Windows machine somewhere that can do all this stuff in order to get the same features on the Mac.
Right. And some of the other things, too, is like some of the formatting stuff. Where on a PC, you can get add-ins and you can get like all these things that do really formatting for OneNote. But as like a Mac user, it's really frustrating because you're just like, I just want a code block. I just want an easy code block. Everything else can do this. Why can't OneNote do this on a Mac?
Or like how when I go to copy and paste a snippet of text from a web browser into OneNote on Windows, it'll paste the blob and it will also include a citation at the bottom saying what URL it was from. But you go to do the same thing on the Mac and it won't do that in OneNote. It'll just paste the blob without the actual source URL that you found it in. It's like, what's exactly up with that? Why isn't that feature parity?
Right. So that's where I wonder, like, to your point, where OneNote is a very mature product that was really only Windows for a really long time. And it's much easier, I think, to have a cross-platform environment and sort of purchase that and work on that than it is to re-platform OneNote when you can just now integrate those things into it.
There is also a potential option 3 where it is Microsoft could invest in Wine or Proton and just port the Windows version of OneNote to the Mac and Linux for that matter, just as the native Windows application, just in Wine. And then maybe a lot of those features could come over. Just thoughts. Microsoft loves open source, do they not? Why wouldn't they like their own reverse engineered version of Windows that the Linux community has been using for so many years?
Well, I think part of it is that there's this huge demand for the web browser type client as well, and having the app version. But also having people really like the being able to see when other people are posting, like the little icons and stuff. I know OneNote kind of does that, but like, I don't know, people like feeling like they're in the room with other people, and OneNote kind of gives you that. But I think apps like these really give you that feeling.
Right. Yeah, no, I totally get that. With OneNote, there is full collaboration in real time. But when you only really can tell when someone makes an edit after they've made an edit, and then it shows a highlight to the right when it shows their initials or whatnot. But as far as I understand, I don't think it ever really showed up with icons like it does in Word, Excel, and PowerPoint when someone's actually there and editing.
Right. And honestly, many of these features were already in Word, Excel, PowerPoint. I don't know if you remember, like, when there was like this chat part of it.
Oh yeah, I remember. You can chat in Excel. The weirdest.
You can chat in Excel. It was so weird, but at the same time, it kind of made it easier. So you don't have to like go over to Teams and be like, "Hey, check this Excel file. Can you do this thing?" Whereas you can just like have the conversation right there. I think it just simplifies it. Do I think it makes a lot of overhead? 100%. So I'd love to see a little bit more of an integration.
I think what we're kind of seeing is like, it's like what, from the eyes of an engineer, we think this is kind of like stupid and redundant. And it's like, why are you making another app for this? But then you kind of look at it from like a user perspective, or maybe the, you know, the less intense technical person viewpoint. And I guess you can see the needs and the use case for it. It's just a matter of perspective.
Right. And it's all about working styles. I think offering a solution for various types of working styles and different team dynamics. So you and I are like, oh, this is a lot of tools. Why aren't you just using OneNote? But for one team, OneNote might be complicated, or you might have Mac users, or you might have combined types of users, and it's just more complex to teach everyone. Or you can just get a tool that is open source and just really lets everyone jump in right out of the gate.
I've spoken with a few people about this, where some people go like, you know how like perhaps your department might have a Teams channel set up for them specifically for their department, so you can do threads and chats and subgroups and subchannels and all that. Do you ever notice that, like, instead of using that channel, your team just instead spins up like a 15-person individual team's chat itself, and you just end up
that
using
drives
that?
Me insane.
I hate it too. It's like, wait, we have this other thing. Why aren't we using that? And then you see people just like somehow either willingly or just out of ignorance not use it. And instead you just do this other thing. It's kind of like when people all subscribe to a 15-person text message thread on phones, like through SMS. It's like, guys, there's like a million different better ways you can chat. Why are you doing this through text message? It's like the same kind of
right.
idea.
It is. And I think it just comes down to is it easy? Is it hard to, like, how long does it take me to do this thing? And that's what, like, general users are, you know? They just want to be able to do it without thinking too much because, like, they have a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, it's like when you run into someone who still emails files to themselves in the age of OneDrive. It's like, why do you still do that?
Because it's just habit. I may
do
still
habit,
do that.
It's easier to them. Yeah. I mean, emailing something to yourself, that's kind of where I draw the line. I'm like, come on, do it a different
way. Okay. But sometimes, sometimes I'm not logged into OneDrive on that thing, and then I have to do 2FA. Yeah. But, like, I may already be logged into Gmail. It takes 2 seconds. 2 seconds to drop that thing right in, and then I have to, like, log into OneNote. That's a whole nother couple of steps.
That's fair. Yeah, the time to productivity. All right, I'll put my foot in my own mouth here, and I'll do the same thing. So I like to use Visual Studio Code for my text editing because Visual Studio Code is great. You know, it's so robust and has all these extensions.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's great.
My problem, and I use OneNote to take notes, but you know what my problem is lately? My problem is Visual Studio Code being an Electron app. It takes a couple of seconds to load, even on a fast computer. You know, even on an M1 Mac, it takes a second or two to load for whatever reason. OneNote, kind of the same problem. Even after OneNote loads, you still have to wait for it to sync. And if you made an edit on a different machine, you got to wait for that to come down. And it's like, if I need to make a note right now, this second, I got to think of the fastest way to do it. So how am I going to do it? I'm actually going to slam Windows and R on my keyboard, and I'm going to open up notepad.exe. And I'm just going to start slamming away at the keys in that because Notepad opens up in a fraction of a second on mostly any computer because notepad.exe is super efficient and was designed with the intent to be opened that fast. Yeah, maybe I'll transfer this text over to OneNote or VS Code later, but it's like while it's hot in my brain, I got to just do it right then and there. So Notepad trumps VS Code and OneNote right there on the spot just because of the ease of use and the speed factor.
Yep, that's exactly it. So I do the same thing. I actually, for that, I use Notepad, but I have gone back to Notepad++ because, again, that's like my comfort.
Oh, yeah.
And I like that it auto-saves. But it's the same thing. It opens way faster than anything.
Yeah, Notepad++ is, yeah, that's one thing. Before VS Code was released, I used Notepad++, but I still, you know, like you said, Notepad++ still loads faster than VS Code in most cases, even today.
So, like, to your point, I typically use Notepad++ as my note-taking app if I need to, like, bang away, like, quick notes or a quick checklist because I don't want to wait, because I know I'll forget while those apps are loading.
Right, yeah. That's something that Microsoft could improve upon greatly, is just the speed of launching apps because the creativity spark doesn't last very long.
Right. So I'm almost wondering if that's what hopefully Loop is aiming to solve, is by having just a native web app, or I mean, it looks like there's actually an app too, but having an app that's open source that just allows you to kind of bang away, make quick notes, quick collaboration. Because I don't think that really exists right now. Everything kind of takes a little bit of work.
Yep. So we just need everything to just be a little bit faster and a little bit better.
I mean, yeah, we're all busy. We all got stuff to do. We don't want to like sit waiting for stuff to load all day. I don't.
Yep. And I sure as heck know I don't either.
So, I mean, we'll see. It comes out in 2022 sometime. I'm a little bit excited to see what else happens and what else, how it transpires. Again, Microsoft is known to change course. They do that on us all the time. Maybe it'll come out in 2030, or maybe it'll actually come out on time.
Yeah, hopefully it doesn't take that long, but it looks like it's on track for 2022 at this point.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm excited to at least see it. Viva, I don't care as much about. I wish I did, but I don't. I still haven't yet like understood how Viva will make my life easier or better.
Yeah, that was something that Microsoft like announced with great fanfare, then we haven't heard much about since, huh? Have you heard much about Viva? Because I've heard absolutely nothing about it ever since it was just kind of awkwardly announced.
So I briefly saw some stuff today that was talked about at Ignite today, but again, I picked what the things that I was interested in, and Viva just was not that. So it's possible.
Hot off the presses from Therat.com. Apparently, Viva is generally available, but that's really the only news about it, I guess. It's like, hey, it's still here. It's out.
I just don't understand it. I think it's a lot of work, and also it looks expensive, like for what it is. Like, let me pay more money.
Yeah, or subscribe to something else, who knows?
Yeah, it's just like all these subscriptions and Microsoft licensing is just getting increasingly more difficult to manage.
Of course.
Yeah, I don't know. Viva is not going to be something I keep my focus on unless someone says, hey, this will like enhance our lives tremendously. But I don't know. It's not on my radar. Maybe more stuff will come out about it, but I still don't really get it. Someday.
Someday.
That's the hope.
All right, so that's, I guess that's everything I could think of, at least from Ignite Day 1 so far. I mean, we're only recording after the first day, so we're probably going to miss anything else that's announced in the coming days, but we shall see.
Yeah, these are just our cliff notes, just some brief thoughts, commentary, all the fun stuff.
Indeed. Moving on from Ignite, I've had some run-ins with PowerShell lately that are starting to get kind of annoying. So it's kind of maybe more core frustrations with the Windows Store than PowerShell itself. With PowerShell, you can install PowerShell 7 amongst one of two ways. You can either go to the GitHub repository for PowerShell 7, you can download it, you can install it through a traditional MSI and a traditional download. That will land the PowerShell pwsh.exe in your program files folder under PowerShell and the 7 folder, and your hunky-dory. It usually integrates with everything just fine with Windows Terminal, VS Code. It'll just kind of just seamlessly work its way through everything, through the magic of the installer and all the integrations, as it should. There's also an alternate version of PowerShell you can also install from the Windows Store, which is meant to be a little bit more ideal in the sense that it'll automatically update itself, you don't have to think about it as much, and it's delivered through the store platform, which is supposed to be more efficient. No web browser, no remembering that it is from github.com, anything like that. The only thing about it, when it's installed, it gets dropped into a different location, specifically C, program files, Windows apps, microsoft.powershell underscore 7.1.5 underscore x64, or whatever version number it currently is, along with random letters and numbers, and then pwsh.exe. So there's a couple of problems with delivering the executable in this way. One, it's more difficult to point to this executable because it is bound by a specific version as well as an ID and everything that comes with that. It's also buried in the Windows Apps folder, which is one of the most heavily locked down folders in Windows I think I've ever seen. Like, you could try to take ownership of this folder and you can't break into this thing. It's really difficult to get in there. And if you want to do any special integrations with it, you're going to be more restricted. And I've also found some adverse behavior. Perhaps it's a glitch. Perhaps it's just something that didn't work right. But when I installed PowerShell from the store, I found that VS Code's integration, namely the terminal and the PowerShell integrated console, it didn't detect PowerShell at that point, even though on my other system it did it just fine. So it's kind of like inconsistent when you use the store version. And then trying to run the executable as a different user, that can also get kind of hairy because the pwsh.exe is located deep in this lockdown Windows Apps folder, and you can't get in there very easily. And then trying to run it as a different user, it just might fail because you might get an access denied to get to the executable. Whereas if you installed PowerShell 7 via the MSI and you went to C, program files, PowerShell 7, pwsh.exe, you could just do it. You could right-click it, run it as a different user, and you'd be fine. So I guess it's like, I really want to believe in the PowerShell Windows Store version, but recently, I found myself switching back to the MSI version because I just have more direct control over kind of everything with it. And the store version, man, it's just annoying. I think it's kind of a core problem with the store, and it's only going to get worse as we move into Windows 11, where Microsoft wants more developers to use the store. And if the Windows Apps folder is the way forward, I'm kind of afraid as to how this is going to work in the future, and especially if PowerShell stops offering an MSI from GitHub and you have to just install from the Windows Store. It's just kind of concerning to me. So that was my little soap opera talk about the different ways to install PowerShell and the strange problems I've run into with them. Maybe I'm unlucky, but that's been life for me lately.
That's interesting. So I saw your notes, so I decided to look it up a little bit. And Microsoft, on their page about the different types of ways to download from like PowerShell 7, the MSI package is the best choice for the everyday user. The zip package is the easiest way to install multiple versions or use in CI/CD pipeline. The .NET Global Tool, a good choice for .NET developers. WinGet is good for users that prefer to use the new Windows Package Manager tool. And the Microsoft Store package, a way to install for casual users of PowerShell, but has its limitations. So that's directly for Microsoft.
Yeah, of course. It's like they're all the same core thing, but they all have different functionalities. And while on the surface, they may all look to be the same happy family. Yeah, wow, the store version, oof.
I don't know why, what made me decide to go look that up. But I wanted to be able to participate in the PowerShell conversation, so
that's important. Like, you actually put more effort into looking up the differences than I did. I just kind of went off my direct experience, but no, I'm happy you actually validated that for me.
No, yeah, you're not wrong. So your findings were correct in that you found the limitations, and now it just now you just have to use the right version.
Yes, and luckily I did catch on while I was experiencing these frustrations, and I uninstalled the store version and I went back to the MSI version.
Right.
I will miss the auto update feature that the store had, but you know what? I can live with it if I can, you know, run it as a different user and get better integration support.
Yes, exactly. Also, like at that case, like would it just be running PowerShell locally that you would use? I don't know what use case you would use the store version for it.
It was mostly just out of laziness and, you know, like I said, the desire to auto update. I get really bugged when open PowerShell and I get that little white text box that says, hey, a new version's available. And I'm like, again? Like, I just updated thing last week. It's like, I like constant updates, but man, it updates a lot.
Well, my point was more like, who would use the store? Who would it be good for? That's what I don't understand.
Well, it could be for, you know, like you said, the casual user who only needs to run a script and not maybe do development work, or they don't have multiple accounts, or they don't have to do sysadmin-y type work.
Yeah.
Those kind of people can run the MSI, but if you're just typical grandma that's got to run a PS1, the store version's for you.
Just like that. Just go to the store version. Do not pass go. Do not collect.
The store version is for the PowerShell grannies.
Oh, the grannies. I almost thought that's me, but that's not me. Because I was installing PowerShell in Homebrew today. So I'm not.
Yeah, I was going to say, you are a power user. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Shout out to using Homebrew on the Mac to install anything, really. Brew install PowerShell, that is the best.
Yeah, it's so good.
Installing PowerShell otherwise on a Mac or Linux, for that matter, is just kind of a weird experience. Okay, sorry, no. Homebrew is just Mac. But, you know, Linux has its own separate package manager.
Yeah, it has a different one.
But on the Mac, yeah, brew install PowerShell is the way to go. Otherwise, you're kind of doing some weird stuff.
At one point, I think I tried the weird stuff, and I was just like, why am I doing this? I can just use brew install. You do occasionally hit some weird like permissioning issues, but that's just Mac OS.
I just got into Homebrew, I think maybe a couple of months ago, and I never realized how much stuff was actually available in it, and that I'd been installing a lot of things on Mac OS like the hard way until I realized that almost all of them were available in Homebrew. And I was like, oh, wow, like this is like a light bulb clicking onto my head. And then I realized like a lot of utilities that I used in Linux are actually available on the Mac through Homebrew.
Yes.
Like the superior htop instead of top. You can install that through Homebrew. You can install Wine through Homebrew.
Yeah.
All this stuff. It's, oh my God, Homebrew is the MVP of the Mac. It kind of made me start to love the Mac again.
So that's exactly it. So I had a period of time where I was exclusively just using Linux on a Mac or like Linux and a Mac in my life. And I forgot about that period of time. When I was reminded of Homebrew, I was like, it was just so nostalgic. I was like, I know about this.
Yeah, it's great.
So that's, yeah, I started using my Mac more again because I just want to be able to keep up with both worlds.
I'll dabble back and forth myself here and there.
A little dibbly dabble.
Little dibbly dibbly dabble.
Little dibbly dabble. I don't know what I'm saying anymore.
Dibbly dabbling is the way. So what is the way, Tiff?
Oh, so one of the other things during Ignite, and this is just something I've been working on in my own time. Wow. Not in my own time, is identity and access management and just the general discussion around passwordless management and why passwords suck. Because they do.
And they do suck.
I mean, they do suck. They are easily apprehended and bypassed. I don't know why I wanted to sound very official right there, but I did. But Microsoft is making a pretty lofty claim, and they're saying passwordless is the way. And I want to agree with them because I don't like passwords. I'm terrible at them. I locked myself out of my GitHub account for months because I'm just really bad at passwords.
And how you had to beg the support people.
Yeah,
to get
to
it
beg
back.
Them to that let and to give it back. Thank you, GitHub user support. You were great. But there are other ways to do this, to go passwordless. And I have been using the Microsoft passwordless through the Authenticator app. And it is great. It is fantastic. I just have to type a number when it pops up. So simple. But there's other ways to do it too. You don't just have to do the solution through the Authenticator app. You don't have to do the one-time passcode. So that would be similar. But you also have biometrics, push notifications, fingerprints. FIDO keys are becoming more popular again. I remember a couple of years ago when I was working on a VDI world and we had the contact center using the tokens, and it was such a pain. And I remember being like, someone said, hey, like, these are going away. Why are we doing this? But they're back now, but they're getting cool.
Because I remember the old days, like in 2012 when they existed. And yeah, they were like early, early two-factor authentication. But yeah, now they're back in style, I guess.
So I have one of the fingerprint YubiKeys. And because I've been testing out Azure Authentication, because our call contact center, because they can't have their phones on the floor, they use authentication through the YubiKeys. So as I'm working through the process of moving to Azure SSO, I want to make sure that they don't have to bring their phones on the floor ever to even set this up. It's just a matter of like, yes, you have your YubiKey. You can just log in. You can just like now connect it to your account and it's good to go. Because not everyone, and I think that's what's really cool about the access tokens, is not everyone has or will have a phone on them. And I think relying on your phone is just stupid.
Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of secure environments, too, where you can't have a phone.
Once upon
a time, I worked at a defense contractor. And yeah, having your phone that was your personal phone was a big no-no. So yeah, there's a lot of use cases where that can be a very, very popular solution.
So one of the cool things about the YubiKey is it actually has like the fingerprint biometric scanner built into it, along with it being a YubiKey. A few weeks ago, when I was getting it set up, it was like, put your finger on it. And I was like, I thought this was just a token, an access token. I thought I just like plug it in and I call it a day. How does it know? Because it wasn't super obvious that it just has a circle on it. And I'm like, I've had thumb drives that have similar looks to this. So I put my finger on it and it's like, you've now been authenticated. And I'm just like, wait, what? And I just like kept touching it. I was like, wait, this is a fingerprint scanner? This is so weird. So I just like kept repeatedly touching it. And I'm like, how can I set this up on everything else? I'm still fighting with getting it to work with Windows. A lot of it, I think, is just me. The other part of it, I think, is just Windows. And then a small part being just things like to fight with me when I want them to work.
I was thinking like a YubiKey with a fingerprint sensor. That's reminding me of like the never released Nintendo Wii Vitality sensor, which was like this like fingerprint thing that attached to the Wii remote. It was demoed like at one E3 and then it was never seen again. Wow, the YubiKey is almost like that.
Yes.
Biometric vitality authenticators. Like imagine if like the Wii remote was like your two-factor authentication device. or something.
You just
like
pick
that.
Up your Weaver Moat and you just start waving her around. You're just like, all right, I'm authenticated.
You're authenticated. It's you.
You're who you say you are for today. Oh, that's funny. I didn't even think about it.
Yeah, it's like how macOS offers a feature where if you're wearing an Apple Watch, you can unlock your Mac. And it has to do with like if the watch is unlocked on your wrist, and I assume maybe it checks for a heartbeat or something. That's like your method of authentication. There's biometric authentication is a cool, nice feature to replace passwords. At the same time, though, there's the same question that I have with Microsoft, which I don't understand if they've solved it or what, but at least in the Apple world, when you restart a device, your first login to a Mac or iOS cannot be via biometrics. It has to be via password or passcode. I read the security white paper for this like a long time ago for iOS, and there was a very specific reason as to why you couldn't like use Touch ID or Face ID as your first time login, because that was some kind of security breach or it was breakable or there was some way around it. What confuses me is like Microsoft has no problem letting you use Windows Hello as your first time login after a first boot and presumably like a YubiKey or whatever. Maybe I'm just not thinking of all the scenarios, but I'm just wondering how Microsoft gets around this, yet Apple absolutely requires you enter a password, not only after first boot, but periodically as well. Like, it's either an arbitrary or random timer, or it's like every 24 hours, Apple will stop all action and say, hey, we know you have Face ID, Apple Watch ID, Touch ID set up for authentication, but we need you to verify your PIN or password before you can proceed to use this method. So I'm kind of curious as to the details of that on that, or if Microsoft either cared to go that far or if they have some other way of working around it for passwordless auth.
So I was reading a little bit ago about like the NIST requirements, and part of it is for password requirements, or not even but like authentication requirements, is that if you're going to be compliant, you have to have two. So if you're looking at two-factor authentication, it has to be two very separate and it can't be on the same machine. So if you're going to do biometrics and a password, I think that's where it kind of that interpretation, and the rules are getting very vague. It's been a while since I've read them. But there's a specific combination that you can do for like authenticating in general. And I'm wondering if like when you restart and that first time you authenticate, you're not technically meeting like the two authentication methods requirement. I don't know, because it's been a while since I've read the NIST and PCI compliance documents. So.
And I don't know if Apple was following that or if they're just going by their own logic or something.
Yeah, it's been a bit. You never know. But no, it's interesting stuff, though. Just the whole, I think that Microsoft is definitely being a bit ambitious, though, in my opinion. I think it's a lot to take on to just be like, oh, yeah, we're like passwordless is the way. Because I don't disagree, but I think it's like pretty ambitious. We can even get a lot of places to adopt identity in general.
I don't know. I guess I have to understand that apparently it's more of like the macro human problem than anything else. It's like at a personal level, when I hear Microsoft saying that it's stupid, like passwords are stupid and overly complex and humans are too dumb to ever know them, I kind of take a step back and I go, I personally don't have a problem with this. I use a password manager. I diligently keep that password manager up to date. And if I need a password, I'll go into it and check it. And I have no problem like changing it, updating it, sometimes typing it. And is this just a problem where like I'm just too good at keeping my passwords organized, and the issue is just the greater public cannot keep that cadence or keep that practice up? Is that like where they're coming from? Because I'm like, personally, at a personal level, like I'm okay with passwords. Like I can handle that on my own time. I'm fine with it.
Yeah.
When they make that statement, I'm like, okay, that's true for maybe most people, but it's not true for me personally. It's weird.
Yeah. No, it's a hard thing to kind of grasp. I'm decent at passwords. I don't lose all passwords. Sometimes I'm in a hurry or I do late night projects and I start getting tired. And again, I open up a notepad file because I'm just like tired and I throw it in there and I'm like, in the morning, I'll put it in the password manager, but then my computer restarts and then it never gets into the password manager. So I guess it's super secure because no one knows the password. And I know it's terrible practices, but I'm not the only person that has terrible habits with passwords. And this is exactly why. And I'm not like this, like during the day or most, it's only in like those instances that I'm in a hurry or I'm not paying attention. And I'm like, oh, it'll just be here for 1 second and I'll copy it right in there and it'll be fine. But how many other people say that?
Yeah. And I guess
and then their computer gets compromised or something happens and now they don't have any password or they're, you know, now they're, all their information is compromised.
Yeah, and I guess that's just the part I have to comprehend. I have weird opinions about passwords that are
You're just good at it.
I guess so. I don't know. I have weird opinions about passwords and authentication that I guess go against most other. I felt weird about when Microsoft and NIST in particular, they said that the practice of changing your password every X amount of days was worthless. And I kind of argue, how is that worthless? In fact, I'd say it's kind of a better defense than nothing if you are an organization that is either too slow to adopt multi-factor authentication or can't, because I'm just thinking like, okay, let's follow your recommendation of changing passwords every X amount of days is useless. Okay, so let's say you have an org of people that use their password, they have their password set as like 12345, and say that org got compromised and there's a password dump on the internet. So now you're saying that it is useless to change your password every X amount of days? Because if that's true, then guess what? That org just became a bigger target because they have no requirement to change their passwords. And there's a there's a data dump out in the internet. Am I not seeing something that they saw? I do fully understand that when you integrate biometrics and passwordless auth and multi-factor authentication, it becomes something different. But I'm just like, no, I think there is value in having a password change policy. Let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater here.
Yeah. I mean, I think that baby went out with the bathwater a long time ago. I agree. I get what they're saying about not about the password expirations and stuff. Because, yeah, people do reuse passwords. And then they get on a dump or I understand it. But to your point, yeah, now there's stuff's everywhere and password 12345, it doesn't matter.
If you force a password update every, you know, after an interval of time, at least it's going to be slightly different. It's better than nothing.
Right, it is. And to your point too, I mean, if you can't enforce 2FA or you can't, you're not at a place where it's possible, that's going to be your best defense, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess my conclusion is like I'm a little bit skeptical of when people say like, oh no, password policies and requiring you change your password every X amount of days is stupid. I'm like, no, I don't think it's stupid. I think you need to kind of carefully analyze your own environment and find when it is useful to have that kind of protection in place. Obviously, there's better ones, but I'd say it's better than having your password be a weak password forever and at least have it be a little bit variable.
100%. And it's going to come down to your local, state, federal, all the fun stuff, compliance and regulatory as well.
Precisely. Yeah. This isn't an applies to everybody situation. But
yeah. And I think that's where it becomes a challenge is because we want to like assume that everyone can just apply and do these steps to prevent things from happening. But not every organization or every person is in the same situation to just go ahead and jump on and be able to implement these things. It's just not possible.
Exactly. Yeah. So, okay. I'm done stating controversial things, I guess.
You're done stating your opinion for tonight?
Yep. I'm done being cranky tonight.
Just for tonight, though.
This is the way.
This is the way.
Okay, I have one update. It's a fun update.
Yay!
This is a State of the Zunion update for November 2nd, 2021. I've been attempting very hard, studious, laborious attempts to get the Zune software working on macOS Big Sur.
Yes!
In Wine. Man, I've been trying to attack this from every possible angle. I've made some advancements, but I haven't yet come to a definitive solution yet. I'd love if I could, because it seems no one else has done it yet, according to Wine HQ. But I've been trying to get the Zune software installed, working, and maybe, God willing, I could get a Zune synced to it through macOS Big Sur or Monterey, whatever OS it ends up being, on an Apple Silicon chip. And I got as far as I was able to futz with the installer a bit. I tried different compatibility modes. I worked through some error messages directly out of the terminal to try to see what I could knock out. And I got quite a few of them minimized or removed by kind of carefully examining some of the GUIDs and mapping them up against like DLLs or issues with drivers. And unfortunately, what that amounted to was I had to have a Windows machine nearby with a working Zune software installation and maybe copy in some files here and there in lieu of a working installer and trying to see if I could just get it to go anywhere. And I was able to get the installer to sometimes work. And then I Googled around trying to figure out what the silent installer switches were for the Zune software back in the day. And that helped a little bit, except it still silently failed. So I didn't really get much farther into the process other than I was able to kind of determine some very specific error messages that still need to be worked out. There's one specifically having to do with the firewall service, where I guess Zune X64 MSI uses it in some way and results with an error 0x8007-0424. When, you know, the more you dive into a rabbit hole of all these different error messages, the more you learn about Windows, ironically, when you're not using Windows. I learned about Wine Tricks and installing .NET frameworks on macOS through Wine Tricks. That was fun.
Ooh.
The Wine Tricks suite is available through Homebrew. It can be installed right alongside Wine, which is cool. And you can do things such as run Wine Tricks .NET 3.5 to install the .NET Framework 3.5 in Wine and macOS, which is awesome. And .NET 3.5 is needed for Zune specifically. And running the direct Zune.exe would proceed a little bit more happily, you might say, but still ran into errors. I tried to install necessary fonts, thinking maybe some of the errors were font-related, so I tried Wine Tricks all fonts. That didn't really make a difference. Then I started looking at some of the CoGet object class errors for different GUIDs not being registered, and I matched it up on a working system against where they were in the registry, which mapped over to mscore.e.dll as part of the microsoft.zune.shell.launchzuneshell. That didn't really get me anywhere. I tried to register that DLL. Didn't work. Long story short, spoiler alert, I didn't get this quite working, but I haven't given up hope, and hopefully someday we'll get this working. On the Wine HQ database, it seems a lot of people have kind of landed in the same place that I've landed. I kind of like this. It's a fun puzzle, and just to try to get this stuff working, and it's amazing kind of what you learn about like Windows and COM objects and .NET and all the little things that make the operating system tick when you're working outside of it in a reverse engineered version of Windows known as Wine.
That's really cool. No, I hope you get it working. It sounds like you're super close.
Yeah, it's been a hobby. It's like it's neither here nor there. It doesn't depend upon anything if I do or don't get it working.
But right,
I kind of just want to get it working just to say I can. That would be pretty hilarious.
No, just for fun. I hope that it works. I'm glad that you haven't given up.
And if I have any breakthroughs, I'll be sure to provide an update in any way possible. I'll post a few of the commands that I was working with in Wine if anyone else wants to try it as well.
Fantastic.
I think that's about everything then, right?
We talked a lot.
And I think now we are at the end of the show of the Help This Hopes podcast.
Help This Hopes.
If you like this stuff, subscribe to our stuff. We're on all the stuffs, like Apple stuff and Google stuff and places you can subscribe to podcast stuff. We're there.
Yeah.
If you like us,
just like stuff,
subscribe, do the rating, do the smash that comment button, all those things.
Ring the bell.
Ring the bell. Ding.
All the things.
Got anything fun going on, Tiff?
No, I'm just, you know, just trying to stay afloat currently. But no, it's we'll see what else comes out from the week, and I've got nothing else.
Yeah, no, me too. Regular old worky, worky, work, work.
Worky, work, work.
I'm trying to get a new episode out of the Things Learned podcast by the end of the week as well, if I can. Up to episode 51 of that show, so that's fun.
That's awesome. Nice work. Nice work. On that.
So check that show out if you're bored as well. It's not a tech podcast, but it's a fun hobby podcast.
All right.
So all right. So I think until next time, we help this hopes. We hope this helps.
Yes. Hope this helps.
We hope this helps.
help this hurt. No, that's not what I, wow. That's just like, wow.
That's something different.
Wow, that's a totally, wow. Okay, I'm going to go now.
We're done. Bye.
All right. Hope this helps.
Hope this helps.